From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jessica Yellen, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Horror in the Holy Land. Five Israelis, four of them rabbis, killed in a bloody axe attack by two Palestinians. It's Jerusalem's deadliest attack in years, and it follows weeks of unrest and tensions over a disputed holy site. Today, dueling responses from Israeli and Palestinian leaders and celebrations by Hamas. This hour on Point, the temple carnage and the battle for the holy city. You can join us on air or online. What's your reaction to the pictures out of Jerusalem, out of Gaza? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. Joining us now from Jerusalem is William Booth, Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The Washington Post. William Booth, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jessica.
So, Bill, tell us, what is the mood in Israel right now?
The mood in Jerusalem is, it's the old cliche, it's one of rising tensions. There's a lot of concern that the events yesterday and some of the previous events up on the Temple Mount, on the Al-Aqsa Mosque Esplanade, are the beginning of a religious war here, a religious conflict. And so that has a lot of people concerned, both the Palestinians and the Jewish Israelis.
What have you learned today about the victims, the assailants, and others involved?
Well, the victims we know were three Americans, a British gentleman, and then an Israeli of the Druze religion who was a policeman who was shot. And one of the victims was a very prominent rabbi. And the two people who were the two Palestinians who were the assailants were a pair of cousins. And they were from an East Jerusalem neighborhood, and they were shot at the scene, and they were buried yesterday afternoon.
You know, there have always been disputes in the Holy City. What is fueling this latest round of violence?
Well, that's one of those questions. It depends on which of the many sides you're asking. But one thing is clear: the move by some Israeli politicians, on the right, to seek permission for Jewish people to go up to the Temple Mount, where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is, the third most holy site in Islam, and to allow these Jewish people to go up and not just wander about as tourists as they do today, where they're forbidden to pray, forbidden to bring any religious insignia or regalia or to pray or to do any sort of religious displays at all. And there's a group of Israelis, it's hard to know how big of a group of Israelis, but there's certainly a very committed core of Israelis that want Jewish people to have the right to go up there, up into this area and pray. And that's a very explosive issue for Palestinians here and really for Muslims around the world. Al-Aqsa is a very precious preserve for them, and they feel like if the Israelis get kind of a toehold up there, you know, even though it sounds, well, why shouldn't you let them pray? But the Muslims feel like if they get a little piece up there, then the area will become sort of bisected, and they'll have to, like, even more fully share it.
Benjamin Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, has, in fact, charged the Palestinian leadership with inciting this violence. What's the basis of that claim?
The base of that claim from Netanyahu and from other folks in the Israeli government is sort of several fold. But one is that the Palestinian Authority president, Mahmoud Abbas, either doesn't speak out forcefully against attacks or with a wink and a nod is permitting them. Abbas yesterday was very strong, saying that that no religious site should be attacked by anyone. And Abbas has been kind of resistant to Israeli demands that he, you know, denounce each new attack. He feels that kind of puts him in a box and feels like that distracts him from his mission, and he is not going to serve, he said in the past, as sort of chief apologist, you know, for the Palestinian cause. But in addition to the president of the Palestinian Authority, there's the group, for example, like Hamas in Gaza. And Hamas applauded yesterday the attack in the synagogue and called it, you know, the Jerusalem operation, and said we hope these revenge operations continue. They didn't take direct responsibility for the act, but they were applauding it, which the Israeli government sees as, you know, obviously incitement.
And what has the response been beyond blaming them for inciting this? How has the Israeli government responded on the ground?
Well, on the ground, very late last night, early this morning, Israeli security forces went into the neighborhood of Silwan, which is right on the edge of the old walls of the old city. And it's a Palestinian, majority Palestinian neighborhood. And there was a Palestinian man from that village, that suburb, that committed a vehicle attack a couple of weeks back. He rammed his car into the Jerusalem light rail metro and killed a 3-month-old baby girl, and then I think a tourist visiting from South America. Anyway, so he rams his car into there. He's shot at the scene also, as often happens here. After he committed this act, and then his family said, well, this was an accident. He didn't really mean to. Most people assume it was an intentional attack. But then today the Israeli security forces went to his apartment, which he shares with his family, and destroyed his apartment, did a demolition.
Bill Booth, you are there on the ground, and you do great reporting for The Washington Post. He's Jerusalem bureau chief. Thanks for joining us.
Anytime. Happy to do it. Thanks.
Joining us now from Washington is Ambassador Martin Indyk. He is former U.S. Special Envoy for Israeli-Palestinian Negotiations and the former U.S. Ambassador to Israel, now at the Brookings Institution. Ambassador Indyk, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Jessica. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. Your first reaction, what does this latest violence signify to you?
Well, it signifies a real breakdown of any process of reconciliation between the Israelis and Palestinians that was manifest in the breakdown of the negotiations that I was responsible for some 4 months ago. But as the Secretary of State warned repeatedly, John Kerry, that is, at the time, the absence of an effort to resolve this conflict leads somewhat inevitably to the kind of conflict that we're seeing now. And the worst part of it is that it's in Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is problematic for several reasons. First of all, Arabs and Jews live cheek by jowl in Jerusalem. It is an open city, decidedly so, because the government of Israel, successive governments of Israel, declared that this is Israel's united, eternal capital. And there are 300,000 Palestinian Arabs in Jerusalem, and the kind of horror terror attack yesterday is just an example of the kinds of things that can happen. We've had a series of these kinds of incidents, none so horrible as yesterday, that come from the fact that the populations intermingle. There is and can be no separation other than some kind of physical separation, which Israeli governments are ideologically strongly opposed to. Secondly, of course, you have the religious dimension in Jerusalem, the crucible of the three monotheistic religions, with the holy places there that are holy to Christians, Jews, and Muslims, but in particular the Temple Mount Haram Sharif, where the Al-Aqsa Mosque is, the third holiest place in Islam, and where the Temple Mount, where the holiest of holies of the Jewish religion is believed to have been before it was destroyed by the Romans. And so you have the one same place, holy to both Judaism and Islam, being the center now of this kind of conflict. And so it has great potential to blow up, to become a religious conflict, and that can drag in many ways the whole Muslim world and certainly the Jewish world.
Prime Minister Netanyahu, in response to this, has sort of stepped up crackdowns and pressures on Palestinians inside Jerusalem, blocking roads to some Palestinian neighborhoods, stepping up arrests of kids who've been throwing stones more in the occupied territories in the West Bank, but also beefing up police patrols and threatening now to demolish the homes of the attackers. Do you think these kinds of steps and more that the Israelis are considering threatens to escalate the problem?
Well, they're in a very difficult dilemma. It's certainly the potential for a crackdown generating greater anger and resentment and therefore more violence is certainly possible. On the other hand, failure to act will just leave the arena open to more terrorist acts and violence. So it's a very difficult dilemma. And I think that because Jerusalem, as I suggested, already presents such a difficult and complicated security challenge, it can't be easily resolved. Demolitions, there's a long history of demolitions, and the Israelis stopped demolishing houses in 2005 because they came to conclude that it actually didn't deter terrorist acts. But now they've started again, almost as a kind of desperation ploy, because they have to show the Israeli public that they're doing something to protect their security, their personal security. And this is something that's very visible and also plays into this narrative that plagues the Israeli-Palestinian conflict of revenge and eye for an eye, which both sides, given their kind of history, kind of react to that in a way that just makes the conflict harder to calm down. But that's the essence of what's needed here, is an effort by both sides to calm things down.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. That is the sound of Israeli families praying for the victims of yesterday's synagogue slaughter in Jerusalem. You can join our conversation. How should the U.S. respond to the latest violence? Did you know any of the Americans killed in the attack? In the aftermath of the bloody attack, there were dueling accusations and accounts of blame from leaders on both sides. Israeli government spokesman Mark Regev told the BBC that the Palestinian attackers share the same values as jihadists from the so-called Islamic State.
We see it, ISIS doing these sort of terrible things in Iraq and in Syria. We see other examples in Yemen and in Libya. Islamic extremism is a regional problem. And there can be no justification for this sort of wanton violence. And, of course, Hamas relishes this sort of thing, but I think mainstream Palestinian leadership has an obligation to unequivocally condemn it, and they've not been willing to do so.
Then Palestinian official Mustafa Barghouti blamed the violence on Israel's continuing occupation.
The reason for all of these problems, which has been going on for 47 years, and for the thousands of Palestinians killed and the Israelis killed, is the continuation of occupation. In my opinion, today is a failure of the international community too, which failed to pressure Netanyahu to accept to end occupation and allow Palestinians to be finally free, to have their own independent state. This vicious cycle will continue.
Still with us, Ambassador Martin Indyk from Washington. He was former U.S. ambassador to Israel. And to bring in a few other voices, joining us from Washington is Shlomo Brome, former deputy to Israel's national security advisor and a retired brigadier general, now at the Center for American Progress. Shlomo Brome, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Jessica.
And with us from Providence, Rhode Island, is Bishara Dimani. He is Palestinian-American and a professor of Middle East history and director of Middle East studies at Brown University. Bishara Dimani, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you, Jessica.
Let me put this one to you, Shlomo. You are in constant contact with folks in Israel. What do you hear from people on the ground there, and how does it look to you?
The atmosphere is very tense, and morale is very low because everyone expects the worst. Everyone expects a further escalation. And the feeling is that the Israeli leadership is not handling the situation well.
Can you elaborate on that? In what way are they not handling it well? What do folks think they should be doing differently?
Well, the timing is very bad because what is happening now in Israel is a combination of very negative process when it concerns the relationship between Israelis and Palestinians in general, with a very unstable political situation in Israel, where everyone is feeling that the elections are clear, that we are close, that we are going to have early elections. And because of that, domestic political considerations get a first priority. So the feeling is that Prime Minister Netanyahu knows very well what he should do to calm down the situation, but he is not capable of doing it because of domestic political considerations, because he is afraid that he will lose his political base of support, which is composed, of course, of right-wing supporters.
Hmm. Bashar Dumani, you know, from the Israeli side, it's clear that there's a perception this attack is somehow different in quality and character because it happened inside a synagogue, because it's in Israel. But from your point of view, do you believe the Palestinians see it in the same way, or is this a continuation of violence we see in the region generally?
It's not the first time there's been religious violence in this conflict. In 2008, eight Jewish students at Jerusalem Yeshiva were killed. And in 1994, I think the real event that started this kind of focus on holy places is the massacre in the Cave of Patriarchs in Hebron, where an Israeli extremist killed 29 Muslim worshippers while they were praying. And he's been turned into a hero by the Israeli settler movement. So this is not the first time. I think Mustafa Barghouti is exactly on point. This is part of a long-term problem that must be dealt with, and that is the occupation of Palestinians. In the case of Jerusalem, I think what's happening now is very worrisome. This has been, for the most part, a colonial conflict, a modern colonial conflict. It's not a primordial religious conflict. Jews, Muslims, and Christians lived in Jerusalem without anything like this happening on a regular basis at all for 1,500 years. This all started really with the waves of European Jewish settlers coming into Palestine to establish a exclusivist Jewish state. And I think we've been seeing these kinds of issues in 1919, 1921. We can give many examples of similar incidents throughout the 20th century. And what's driving all of this is exactly the fact that there is a real commitment on the part of the Israeli government to dispossess Palestinians of their land and to empty them out of Jerusalem to the extent possible. And that is creating huge conflicts. We have to distinguish here between the daily violence, the grinding daily violence of occupation, with these spectacular kind of killings that I think everybody abhors. Every day, the Palestinians in East Jerusalem are subjected to racism, to humiliation, to physical abuse, and their neighborhoods are being invaded, and their lands are being taken away, and there is a political vacuum. Just like Benjamin Netanyahu's hands may be tied because of the incoming Israeli elections, the Palestinian Authority has no real authority on East Jerusalem because of Israeli policy. And these 300,000 Palestinians who have been marginalized, have been impoverished in the last 10, 15 years especially, who have been subjected to attempts to come over into their exclusive neighborhoods and build Jewish settlements there, have no real leadership and in many of these cases are acting out on their own out of desperation.
Ambassador Indyk, may I ask you to come in here, former U.S. ambassador to Israel. The list of legitimate grievances is long. I'm curious what you think President Obama could do, if anything, to help tamp down the tension there right now. If you were still in the job, what would you advise him to do?
Well, first of all, let me just say that whatever the justification in terms of the treatment of Palestinians, nothing can possibly justify the horrendous act of violence that took place yesterday in the slaughter of Jews at prayer. In terms of advising the president, first of all, let me make clear, I resigned my job as special envoy for the negotiations a few months ago, so I don't speak in any way for the U.S. government. I think the first priority for the United States is to calm the situation down as best we can. Secretary Kerry tried to do that with some success when he met with Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Abbas in Amman, Jordan, with King Abdullah last week. That has served to calm the situation on the Temple Mount, Haram al-Sharif, which is the most important thing at the moment, is to avoid a blow-up there, as we discussed before, because of the potential for this to become a religious conflict. And it seems that the right-wing extremists who are pushing for Jewish prayer on the Temple Mount and constantly going up there as a source of provocation, they seem to have backed off and been told to back off by the Israeli government. So I think that's the first step, is continue in that course of trying to calm the situation. Secondly, it's very important, I think, that both Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Abbas exercise responsibility in this situation. The some statements by Abu Mazen in the past have not been helpful, and certainly the lambasting of President Abbas by Prime Minister Netanyahu and the blaming him for what's happened here is not helpful either. It was interesting to see that the head of the Shin Bet security services, Yoram Cohen, spoke to the Israeli Knesset yesterday and said specifically that Abu Mazen is not inciting, Abu Mazen is against terror, and that the provocations were coming from right-wing extremists in Israel. And that break between the Israeli prime minister and his Shin Bet security chief is quite stunning. I can't remember a precedent for that. But I think it reflects an indication of what's so important here. The head of Israeli security knows that security coordination with the Palestinian security forces is essential. And that is happening because Abu Mazen has ordered it to happen, and he's been unflinching in his opposition to terrorism. And we have to build on that. And so I think it's really important that the two leaders back away from these this rhetorical slanging match and act responsibly in terms of calling on their followers on both sides to back off, calm down, and in that way try to prevent this conflict from getting completely out of control.
I just want to remind our listeners what the debate is over the Al-Aqsa Mosque. It's a holy site recognized by both Jews and Muslims. That's where the Jewish, ancient Jewish temple once stood, and some religious Jews are calling for access to the mosque now. But it is also one of the holiest mosques in all of Islam, and Jews have not been allowed to pray inside the mosque. Muslims fear that Jews will start to take it over, and that is a source of debate, conflict, and grave concern on both sides. I'd like to play for a moment a soundbite from Benjamin Netanyahu, Prime Minister of Israel, talking yesterday as he condemned the attack.
There are some who want to uproot us from our state and capital. They will not succeed. We are in a battle over Israel, over Jerusalem, our eternal capital. That's Benjamin Netanyahu's. Those are Benjamin Netanyahu's words, calling Jerusalem Israel's eternal capital. Shlomo Brom,
is this, I heard Bashar al-Dumani say that this is not a religious battle, this is really a political battle over occupation, but Jews are seeing this differently in Israel, that this has taken a turn to a religious war.
Jews are seeing it differently, and I am afraid that many Palestinians are also seeing it differently, because it's true, it started to is a struggle between two national movements. The Zionist movement, which is the national liberation movement of the Jewish people, and the Palestinian national movement. But as it is often happens, it is gradually turning into a religious war. One reason is the winds that are blowing in the Middle East. We are seeing the phenomena of ISIS and other similar phenomena in the Middle East. And the other reason is that I am afraid that Jerusalem is not united, but the extremists in the two sides are united, and they are united in their wish to pour more oil on the fire, because it serves their political interests. So it's true for the religious right wing in Israel. It is true for Hamas and Islamic Jihad in the Palestinian side. And their interest is to turn it into a religious war.
I'd like to also ask you, Shlomo, you were a not just an advisor to Israel's national security, a deputy to Israel's national security advisor, but served in the military there. How is this different for Israel? Because the attackers were not coming over from the West Bank. They lived in East Jerusalem. They had papers to work inside Israel. And it seems that the response might have to now be a new challenge for Israel's intelligence service.
Well, nothing is really new in this conflict between us and the Israelis. We used to have attacks in the past by Palestinians that live in East Jerusalem and use their ability to travel freely in Jerusalem and actually in all the territory of the State of Israel. What is, I think, now different is the fact that it is happening on a background of a relative calm in the rest of the West Bank. Everything is focused in Jerusalem. And the real problem is that because East Jerusalem was annexed to Israel, and then it is under the jurisdiction of the Israeli police. And the rest of the West Bank is under the jurisdiction of the Israeli, of the IDF, of the Israeli military forces. And I am not sure that the Israeli police is capable of dealing with this problem alone. But on top of that, I agree that the problem is not pure security. It's not the security steps that have to be taken and probably will be taken. It's a political problem, and so it should have a political solution.
Bashar, let me ask you about the response inside Gaza. And I know that is only a piece of the response. The attack was condemned by Mahmoud Abbas. But there were celebrations inside Gaza, loudspeakers praising the attack, candy being thrown, a rally. Can you explain it?
Well, I'm not sure what to say, because I don't think any of your listeners have ever lived in a open-air prison like Gaza, which has just went through its own a very traumatic experience of the Israeli invasion during the summer, in which 2,000 Palestinians, most of them civilians, many children, were massacred as well. And I'm really worried, and I agree with Shlomo, that this is shifting over into a more and more of a religious war, and primarily because there is no political horizon. What we have is a situation of the impossibility of coexistence along with the impossibility of separation.
This is On Point. I'm Jessica Yellen in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour about the frightening attack in a Jerusalem synagogue and what it means for peace. You can join the conversation. Are you satisfied with the responses to this horror? Does it make you lose hope in the possibility of peace? We're talking now with Ambassador Martin Indyk and Bishara Dumani, Professor and Director of Middle East Studies at Brown University, and Shlomo Brome, former deputy to Israel's National Security Advisor. Bishara, I'd like to go back to you because right before the break, we were talking about the reaction in Gaza and why some were celebrating after the synagogue attack.
Yes, I was talking about the impossibility of coexistence along with the impossibility of separation is the situation is driving many people now to extremes. And this is, I'm afraid, a result of deliberate Israeli policy of building the infrastructure for creating a single Israeli political space over all of historic Palestine while playing to the international world this song of the two-state solution. And what's happening now, I feel, is that the Israeli government, after decades of building the infrastructure for integrating this entire region under a single regime, is moving in a very deliberate way to leave behind the two-state possibility and declare a legal annexation after a period of de facto annexation. And I think that's what's really driving many people mad. They just don't see how and what they can do, the Palestinians, that is, in order to stop this from happening. And I think that all people who are under this kind of situation of military occupation have an internationally enshrined right to defend themselves, even using violence. But in the case of the Palestinians, it's very important, I think, for pragmatic and other reasons that they continue what has essentially been a process of civil disobedience on a daily basis that the media doesn't pay much attention to, but I think preserves for them a sense of dignity and a high moral ground and how they can try to survive and change the situation, even though they're very weak and they don't have not only the support of the Arab world behind them, they don't have the support of the international governments or the United States. And so they are faced with a very, very strong adversary.
That's their experience, that they don't have this support.
No, they don't have this support, and yet they're expected to behave in a very sort of civil way while their lives are being crushed.
Let me pause for a moment and go to the phones, because we're getting a lot of calls, as you can imagine. I'd like to bring in Paul calling from Metairie, Louisiana. Did I just mangle the name of your town?
Yeah, Jessica, it's okay. It's Metairie.
Thank you. What's on your mind?
Okay, I'll tell you that I'm just going to start with a little story. When I was a little boy, I did something and my father punished me, and then I did it again. And he said, if that didn't work, I'm going to find something that will. You know, I think what Israel is too concerned about what the international community thinks about how they respond. This gentleman just said that someone who is attacked has a right to defend himself. And then he complained about the fact that Israel defended itself against all those rocket attacks. That's the kind of duplicity that you get from that side that doesn't make any sense at all.
Okay, I'm grateful for this point of view, and we're going to bring in some others. Paul, thanks for the call. Hannah is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Hannah. What's your point of view?
Hi, Jessica. I would like to extend sympathy for the victims and their families, but I have to remind our listeners that extremists have no faith and they belong to no religion. Every time they say the word Islamic extremism, you have to understand that these people are not Muslims. They are a bigger problem for Muslims as compared to non-Muslims. Just treat them as people with no faith.
Thank you for the call, Hannah. We're going to move on to Mary calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Mary. You're just around the corner. What's on your mind?
The presenter twice said that Jews wanted to pray on the at Al-Aqsa Mosque. The fact is, Jews do not want to pray at the mosque. They want to pray at the Temple Mount, which is the holiest site in the Jewish religion. Also, when the Jews liberated the old city, the first thing they did was to hand over the keys to all the Muslim holy places to the Muslim Waqf, which was in complete contrast to what happened when the Jordanians controlled the old city for 19 years, when they ethnically cleansed all the Jews out of the East Jerusalem and destroyed all the Jewish holy places.
Mary, thank you for the call. Thank you for your point of view. Eli is calling from Cooksville, Tennessee. Hi, Eli. What's on your mind?
Hello. Look, I'm Jewish. You've got to see the situation from both sides. They've made a deal not to fight, not to fire, not to fire a shot, and both sides have broken that peace treaty. They just made it after all of the atrocities on both sides again, and the cycle will continue. I think the only solution now, and I think one of the final solutions will be a UN peacekeeping force monitoring this. You know, the next treaty. Don't make a treaty. But neither side is capable of keeping these treaties. They all know that. So let's keep a peacekeeping force in there, send them in there, and let them do the job.
Thank you for the call. Ambassador Indyk, let me bring you back into this conversation. Is there a step forward, you see, for the leadership on both sides now to not the U.S., but for the leadership of the Palestinians and the Israelis to calm the situation?
Yes, I think that is essential now. It starts with, on the Israeli side, avoiding any kind of act which would be seen as provocative on the Palestinian side. That particularly applies to settlement activity and building in East Jerusalem. Something that's been going on in the last few months in a way that's provoked not only the Palestinians but the whole international community. And I think given the nature of the tinderbox nature of this explosive situation, it would be particularly important to avoid that kind of activity or announcements of that kind of activity at the moment. On the Palestinian side, I think it's very important for Abu Mazen to send a clear signal.
Can I just clarify that's also Mahmoud Abbas? For listeners who don't know, he goes by both names. Go ahead.
President Abbas, thank you. It's very important that he send the signal against acts of violence. He condemned the violence yesterday, and I think he needs to send out a very clear signal and get his own party, the Fatah party, to fall into line there as well. That's not easy in this situation, but it requires his leadership. And thirdly, both leaders need to step up the security coordination that has been going on under the radar. But the Palestinian security forces are under intense pressure to break off that coordination because they're seen to be agents of the Israeli occupation. Abu Mazen President Abbas has remained committed to that. But they need to find a way to maintain that. And that's why, as I said before, they both need to step back from the kind of slanging match, and particularly on the Israeli side, Israeli leaders lambasting President Abbas in a way that I think is highly counterproductive at this critical moment.
Bashara Dumani, Director of Middle East Studies at Brown University. We heard one of the callers say, look, this isn't an Islamic reaction. This is Islamic extremism that shouldn't be confused with a cause of the Palestinians. I'm wondering if you're concerned that an attack like this is actually destructive to the cause of the Palestinians, if it sets it back in both the global public opinion and the politics of the politics on the ground.
I agree with the caller that this is not a situation where you have the Palestinians suddenly turn into ISIS supporters. They have been involved in this struggle for freedom for a very long time, long before there was an ISIS. And to conflate them, I think, would do a disservice to understanding what the real cause of the conflict are. Having said that, I mentioned earlier that Palestinians can be much more effective using forms of civil disobedience, and they have been. They just don't get a lot of attention for it, but they have been on a daily basis engaged in civil disobedience. They are completely outmatched militarily. Anytime that there is any kind of violence against Israelis, they pay a very, very high price, while everyday violence against Palestinians is not big news. And so they are in this very, very difficult position where they have to maintain their composure and their dignity in the face of a daily grind and onslaught that after 47 years of the 67 occupation, after a very long time of their ethnic cleansing in 1948 as one of the largest and oldest refugee populations in the world, then their issues are not being resolved. And every day there is one less meter of land that they control and one less Palestinian in their, able to stay in their home. Yet they have to maintain, I think, the high moral ground in this conflict for a variety of reasons. And the best way to do it is to keep organizing on a civil disobedience campaign, come what may. And I think that's the best way forward.
Shlomo Brum, former deputy to Israel's national security advisor, we've talked a little bit about how the U.S. and Israel should react, but you're concerned that domestic politics on the ground will intervene. What are you concerned will be the reaction in the coming days by Israel's leadership?
First, I must react to what was said earlier and say that nobody has the right to murder people that pray in a place of worship, whether it is a synagogue or a mosque. And I'm saying it as an Israeli that agree that people have the right to rebel against occupation and oppression. My concern is that because of domestic considerations, the leaders in the two sides, Mr. Netanyahu and other government ministers, as well as President Abbas and Palestinian leaders, are more engaged in a blame game, in the usual blame game, and we have seen some examples of this blame game in our talk, in some of the things that the questioners asked. It is not helpful now. What is helpful now is to cooperate in taking steps in the short term to calm down the situation, and that should be done by avoiding provocations, by taking only the necessary security steps. And I agree that demolition of houses of people is not a useful step. It didn't prove as useful in the past, and it should not be done. But that's what should be done. The problem is that I am afraid that a great part of it will not be done because the leaders in both sides are afraid that they will lose their own base of support. And specifically, Prime Minister Netanyahu, who is afraid, concerned that that he is going to early elections, is turning back to his traditional base of support, which is the right wing, and he has to show them that he is a tough leader, and you show that you are a tough leader by attacking the other party, by lambasting President Abbas, by demolition of houses, by harsh police actions in East Jerusalem, etc. I don't believe that it is helpful.
I'd like to thank you. Go back to Bashar Dumani for a moment and ask you to address something that Shlomo Brom brought up at the beginning of his comments. We have heard you've said that you prefer civil disobedience, but I'm curious: do you believe that this attack in the synagogue was justified?
No, I don't believe it's justified to murder anyone. And that goes without saying. And I'm not sure how good this question is, because I don't hear it being asked of ordinary Israelis every time their government or some Israeli settler kills a Palestinian. So I think it's important to maintain a uniformity of and the value of life and not make one kind of life more important than the other. I think the real question is how can we move beyond this kind of a situation in which there is a serious political vacuum that opens the door wide for turning what is essentially a colonial and national conflict into a religious one. And I think looking at the structures that produce these kinds of effects is what's really useful.
I'd like to thank all of you for a thoughtful conversation on an incredibly complicated and emotional topic. Former Ambassador Martin Indyk, Vice President and Director for Foreign Policy at the Brookings Institution, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Shlomo Brom, visiting fellow at the Center for American Progress and former deputy to Israel's National Security Advisor, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And Bishara Dumani, Professor of Middle East History and Director of Middle East Studies at Brown University. Thanks for your time and thanks for being on with us today.
Thank you, Jessica.
And listeners, thanks to you as well. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpoint.org. Coming up tomorrow, you're supposed to have a clean slate after bankruptcy, but it's not always true. Stay tuned. This is On Point.